So moving right along, the Majjhima Nikaya number 144, Channavada Sutta. So this is one of the Channas. This is not the Channa who was the Buddha's charioteer, but it's another Channa. And this sutta being interesting in a number of respects, but especially because it's one of the very rare cases where an arahant or a monk commits suicide. Okay. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove of the squirrel's sanctuary. At that occasion the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahajunda, who's the Sariputta's younger brother, and the Venerable Channa were living on the mountain Vulture Peak. Now on that occasion the Venerable Channa was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Sariputta rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Mahachunda and said to him, "Friend Chunda, let us go to the Venerable Channa and ask about his illness." "Yes, sir," Venerable Mahachunda replied. Now, according to the Chinese, or I should just mention with the Chinese versions before we start, sorry, my mistake, where is the tables here? Let me get the table for that one. So here's the parallel. So in this case, we have one Chinese parallel in the Samyukta Agama, and the sutta is repeated in the Samyukta Nikaya. So it's repeated in one place, and we have one parallel sutta. So. So, okay, coming back to the text. In the Chinese parallel, the companion is not Mahachunda but Mahakotita, as one of the other great disciples. When Sariputta and his companion came to Channa's presence, then Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahachunda went to Venerable Channa and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down at one side, and the Venerable Sariputta said to Venerable Channa, "I hope you're getting well," and so on. And he said, "I'm not getting well. My painful feelings are increasing, as in the previous sutta. I will use the knife, friend Sariputta. I have no desire to live." Crikey. Imagine if you went to see a friend and to talk to them when they're on their deathbed, and they said, "I'm going to use the knife." I don't know, spread butter on bread. Coffee and growing. I'm going to use the knife. Be quiet. Weird, wouldn't it? Okay, so then Sariputta says, presumably Sariputta says, "Let the Venerable Channa not use the knife. Let the Venerable Channa live. We want the Venerable Channa to live. If he lacks suitable food, I'll get suitable food for you. If you lack suitable medicine, I'll go in search of suitable medicine for him. If he lacks a proper attendant, I shall attend on him. Let the Venerable Channa not use the knife. Let the Venerable Channa live. We want the Venerable Channa to live." And just to sort of make a sort of a little side point here, but you have this, you know, this is Sariputta's character according to the Pali suttas and the early texts, and probably his actual real character. You know, you see that he's concerned about his fellow bhikkhus who are sick, and he's the one who takes the initiative to go and visit them. And then when he hears that he's, you know, contemplating suicide, he's so warm and supportive and say, "We want you to live, and anything that you need, I'll do that, and I'll take that responsibility and find it," and so on. And this is very much the character of Venerable Sariputta. Of course, in the later texts and some of the Mahayana suttas, Sariputta became kind of the caricature of a monk who's kind of unfeeling and unhelpful and almost like a kind of a selfish, rigid, uptight kind of monk. And that certainly bears little relation to the Sariputta we find in the historical texts. And Chanda replies, "Friend Sariputta, it is not that I have no suitable food or medicine or no proper attendant, but rather, friend Sariputta, the teacher has long been worshipped by me with love, not without love. And it is proper for a disciple to worship the teacher with love and not without love. Friend Sariputta, remember this, that Bhikkhu Channa will use the knife blamelessly." Now, when Channa is saying that he has long worshipped the teacher with love and not without love because this is proper for the disciple, he's making an implicit claim to be an arahant. Yes. And he's reinforcing that when he's saying that he's going to be using the knife blamelessly. No. Yes. Okay, so let's have a look at the parallel passages here. So both of them, or both versions are similar in that in all these respects. The Chinese version does not have the Channa saying that his suicide is going to be blameless. The Chinese version merely says that he speaks of that the pains were hard to bear. "Yet my disease oppresses this body with extreme pain that is difficult to bear. I wish to kill myself since I do not delight in a life of pain."
There's
another one which I think was in the earlier version of this text, which Analia seems to have omitted here. In the early version of the comparative study, Analia takes up this thing about the worship of the teacher, and there are actually a number of passages where similar things are said, and where that seems to be the implication of that particular passage, that somebody who's really worshipped and who really loves their teacher, really loves the Buddha, would become an arahant, and that's the proper way to pay respects to the Buddha.
What's the Pali word for love of this?
Yes, that's a good question. Let me see. Get the Pali text. Etanhiavasa Sariputta Savakasapati Rupang Yang Satarang Paricharaya Manapeneva no Amanapena. So this is the word he's using with love, is Manapa. Manapeneva. Basically with love or with affection or something like that, yeah. Parichinno worship. Parichinna, I'm not sure if we've worshipped is the best translation there. Parichinna is almost like served or attended to.
Yeah.
or done the duties towards. I've done my duties for my teacher here. Yeah, I've done my duties for the Buddha. More than worshipped, yeah. Served, something like that, yeah. Been served with affection, not without affection. So when he says this, now the interesting part about this is that when he says this, I mean, of course, this is a difficult situation for Sariputta and the other monks. What do you do, right? And it's a very, you know, it's an interesting one to consider because, you know, of those of you who are monastics here, sooner or later you will be in this situation. I'm telling you. Of going to visit somebody who's, well, maybe, yeah, why not? For doing it yourself, I mean, it happens. It happens constantly. I mean, it's not a rare thing. And, you know, you'll be in a situation where you'll go and see somebody or talk to somebody and they'll be asking you about these things. You know, my grandma is on the deathbed. Should she use the knife? Well, these days they don't use knives so much. But the idea is pretty much the same, yeah. It's very, very common. Yeah, it's constantly comes up. I mean, almost every time someone dies, frankly, these days. I mean, they keep them alive, and you know, it's rare that you know. I mean, sometimes people just die suddenly and quickly, but most of the time, they're there for a prolonged time on the deathbed, and these issues come up. So what do they do? So then Sariputta obviously seems to have a certain doubt about Channa's claims here. So he said, well, we would ask the Venerable Channa certain questions if Venerable Channa finds it opportune to reply. Ask, friend Sariputta, when I've heard, I shall know. So it's interesting how they're, you know, they're approaching this topic. It's very, very respectfully, you know, Sariputta saying, well, I don't believe you. You're not an arahant. But, and, you know, Channa's not actually saying, well, look, I'm an arahant, so just give me a break, right? Unlike certain Dhamma teachers today who, you know, prefix arahant to their name, sort of sell books under the title of arahant so-and-so and so-and-so. So even here when, you know, you have these very high-level monks meeting each other, they still don't say, well, I'm an arahant, so don't worry about me. But
there's some people who put the word Buddha in their name.
Yeah, so I suppose the ones put arahant are quite humble. Yeah.
There you go.
That's right, yeah. Okay, so friend Channa, do you regard the eye or eye consciousness or things cognizable by the mind through eye consciousness? Thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Do you regard the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, mind consciousness and things cognizable by the mind through mind consciousness? Thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Okay, so as with the previous teaching, then we have, of course, a lot of parallels with the previous teaching, the whole deathbed scene, the pains increasing and so on, and then this teaching on the six senses. I suspect, you know, if you take a step back and ask why are these teachings on the six senses being emphasized in the context of the deathbed, I suspect the reason might be because if you look more generally at the suttas, the teachings on the five aggregates are a little bit more theoretical. They're a little bit more about, you know, understanding, you know, the sense of identity and so on and so forth. Whereas the eye and the senses is more about experience, it's more about feeling. And when you're lying on the deathbed, what these people are talking about is these very painful feelings that they have. They're not saying, I have doubts about the Dhamma and can you clear my doubts? They're saying, I'm experiencing these painful feelings. And this is the direct issue. So I think this is why the six senses is introduced at this particular point in both of these suttas. Of course, I should have remarked earlier, but this chapter, this group of 10 suttas is the Salayatana Vagga. So all of the suttas in this chapter deal with the six senses in one form or another. So Channa gives his reply. Friend Sariputta, I regard the eye consciousness and things cognizable through eye consciousness. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And similarly with the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body and the mind. Friend Channa, what have you seen, what have you directly known in eye consciousness and in things cognizable through eye consciousness that you regard them thus? This is not mine, this I am not. This is not myself. What have you known and seen relating to the other senses that you regard them thus? And Channa replies, friend Sariputta, it is through seeing cessation, through directly knowing cessation in the eye, in eye consciousness, in things cognizable by the mind through eye consciousness, that I regard them thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. It is knowing, is through seeing cessation, through directly knowing cessation in the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, that I know these things. So his insight into impermanence and into the cessation of consciousness has led to his seeing through the notion of a self. Obviously, if something ceases, if it's not there anymore, then it can't be yourself. When this was said, Venerable Mahachunda said to Venerable Channa, therefore, Channa, this instruction of the Blessed Ones... before I go on with that one, I'll just come back to the comparative study. And the comparative study, there's nothing interest to say because they're all the same. Okay, moving along. Then, when it was said, Venerable Mahachunda said to Venerable Channa, therefore, friend Channa... So in the Chinese version, this is Mahakotita who's now saying this. This instruction of the Blessed Ones is to be constantly given attention. There is waving in one who is dependent. So notice this word dependent coming back in again. There is no wavering in one who is independent. So this is kind of very nice, and this almost kind of paradoxical statement, because normally if you've got something to depend on, then you think you can be steady, right? So, and when you don't have anything to depend, nothing to lean on, that's when you shake. Whereas the Buddha is saying that it's when you are dependent that you're shaking, because the thing that you depend on itself is dependent, and the thing that depends on is also dependent, and the thing that depends on is also dependent. So there's no escaping from that what's translated as wavering here. It doesn't necessarily mean, normally when we use wavering, we mean somebody who has an idea and then is wavering that idea, but this is more general than that. This means something trembling or shaking. I'll show the Pali in just a minute. We'll just finish the passage and then we'll look at the Pali. Yeah, it's a very beautiful passage in the Pali. When there's no wavering, there is tranquility. When there's tranquility, there is no bias. When there's no bias, there's no coming and going. When there's no coming and going, there's no passing away and reappearing. When there's no passing away and reappearing, there's no here, nor beyond, nor in between. And just this is the end of suffering. So this being here, notice that Mahachunda, or in the Chinese version, Mahakotita, is quoting this passage of the Buddha's. And it is in fact a passage which we find attributed to the Buddha in a number of other places. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi has a footnote there which I won't look at, but we'll give the references to the other places, certainly in the Udana and probably elsewhere. Okay, so you should constantly pay attention to it. Nietzsche Kappang. Interesting. You should Nietzsche constantly. Kappang. Nietzsche Kappang. Nietzsche Kappang. You should always think about this. You should always pay attention and think about this. Nisitasa Chalitang. So of the dependent, there is
shaking.
Shaking all over. Of the independent, there is no chalita, no trembling. When there is no chalita, when there's no trembling, there's tranquility. Pasaddhi. Pasaddhiya sati. When there is pasaddhi, notice the, for the Pali geeks in the room, notice the use of the locative absolute. Chalite. Locative absolute, chalite asati, same as independent in the idapachayata. Imasming asati idang nahoti, same grammatical construction. Pasadhiya sati nati nahoti. Okay, so there's no, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated it as bias. Not really bias, is it? No.
Yeah.
It, bending, literally is bending. Normally it means bending. or like it's from this, it's from the same root as namati, bent, bending, bent, inclination. There's no inclination. So from the same root as namati, bankrupt. Oh. There's no bankruptcy. Oh, well, that would be a good piece of advice for these days. Yeah, so no inclination perhaps might be the best translation there rather than bias. Yeah, so the mind's not inclined towards one thing or the other. So this is the idea, when there's no, when the mind's tranquil, it doesn't go following one thing or the other, right? It's not going out to this or going out to that. It's not inclined one way or the other. When there's no inclination, agati gati nahoti, so there's no coming and going, literal translation. But the implication here is also to do with rebirth as well, because gati is words used for a state of rebirth. When there's no coming and going, there's no chatupapato, there's no passing away and reappearing. And this is rather more explicitly referring to the notion of rebirth, and chuti and upata being the standard terms for to die and reappear. When there is no chatupapate, asati, nevidha, there is no idha, no here, na hurang, no beyond, na ubhayamandarena, no in between the two, esevanto dukkhasa, just this is the ending of suffering. So, very, very beautiful teaching. It's one of my favorite passages. And, you know, moving just from this understanding, you know, this is, and to me this is expressing the core, or the core insight of dependent origination, being expressed in a very pithy form. That there's this sense in which the mind, and we looked at this in the previous sutta, the mind, in the Anasapindikavada sutta, where the mind seeks for dependence on the eye and the ear and so on and so forth. So it wants, it believe that you can find something reliable, something that's steady, something that you can count on through experiencing things. But as long as you do that, the mind, there's going to be trembling, because none of those things that you think that you can rely on actually can be relied on. They're all conditioned as well. They're all impermanent as well, and they will all pass away as well. So according to Channa's kind of insight earlier, you know, he saw cessation in these things. And so when you see cessation of them, then you don't rely on them anymore. You don't be attached to them. And so when you're not attached to them, then there's no trembling, no agitation, no disturbance. And then peaceful, yeah, the mind is peaceful, pasaddhi, tranquility. And then you're not bending and inclining one way or the other. Yeah, so this is perhaps the most important part of it here, is the nati. You're not going after one way or the other, but you're just peaceful, just tranquil the whole time. Because you're not going after one thing or the other, then the mind doesn't get reborn in any particular place. And so when
I think it should be not bending to any...
Not bending, yeah.
Not tending. Not tempting by any just stimulation.
Not tempting.
Yeah.
Nati should be tempting, you think?
Yeah.
Tempting, yeah. Yeah. And so then there's no here. So no this world, no hurang, no next world. And then no ubhayamantarena. So this being one of the quite a few passages in the Pali Canon that suggests the existence of what they call the antara bhava, being the intermediate state. And of course in the Theravadan tradition rejects the intermediate state. Most of the other Buddhist traditions accept an intermediate state between one life and the next. And so passages such as this seem to refer fairly clearly. Idha obviously means this life, hurang means the next life, and ubhayamantarena, it's hard to know what it might mean if it doesn't mean an in-between state. And so there are a number of passages like that. Just this is the ending of suffering.
We look at the word blameless while we are at the
Pali. The word blameless. Yep. So the word blameless is Anupavajjo. Anupavajjo.
And it just says very blameless.
Pretty much, yeah.
But what does the... how do you elaborate on that? I'm going to kill myself, but blamelessly.
Yeah, I'm not doing anything wrong. No, no, it doesn't mean you're not blaming it on anyone. It means that nobody can criticize you for doing it. Yeah, you're not doing anything which is worthy of criticism. Yeah.
But that applies to an arahant. What is a... In your example, what if some sick person is in hospital bed?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you kill
oneself, yeah.
Then can you also just declare...
I'm blameless?
Yeah.
Well, interesting question, isn't it? Let's have a look more through the sutta and let's see whether that maybe give us something else that's going to help us to understand that point. Yeah. Okay, so when Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahajunda had thus advised Venerable Channa, they rose from their seats and went away. Soon after they'd gone, Venerable Channa used the knife. Obviously, yes. Then the Venerable Sariputta went. This is the Venerable Sariputta went to the Blessed One after paying homage to him. He sat down at one side, said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Venerable Channa has used the knife. What is his destination? What is his future course?" Okay, in other words, where is he going to get reborn? How does he know? He doesn't know. He's asking the Buddha.
After they've gone, he used the knife, and
then
he goes and
reports
to the Buddha.
Oh, so how did you know that he used the knife? I don't know. I guess they just heard it on the grapevine. Yeah, well, this is monastic life we're talking about. It doesn't take long for things to get around. So, yeah. So Sariputta. Where did he get reborn? And Sariputta says, and then the Buddha says, Sariputta, didn't the Bhikkhu Channa declare to you his blamelessness? So. In this case, it does seem that Sariputta is not able to or not using his psychic powers to see where he'd been reborn, whether he... Yeah, this is a somewhat controversial question, but yeah, anyway, in this case he didn't. So Sariputta, and then Buddha says, didn't Bhikkhu Channa declare to you his blamelessness? So clearly, both the Buddha and Sariputta here are understanding by blameless as being he's an arahant and therefore can't be criticized for doing what he's doing. And as he's an arahant, then he's obviously not going to get reborn anywhere. So the question wouldn't make sense. So again, the way they're talking about it is quite discreet. It's almost like a code. They're not sort of talking in such direct ways, but it's also quite clear what they mean. Sariputta replies to the Buddha, there is a Vajjian village called Pubbajira. The Venerable Channa had families that were his friends, families that were his intimates, families that were blameworthy. Okay? So now we understand why, Sariputta had this doubt about Channa, because he used to hang around and was very close to these, families who were blameworthy, and moreover, were Vajjians, and everybody knows what the Vajjians were decadent and renowned sensualists. So if anyone who's hanging around with those Vajjians who are always going around in their matching outfits and chariots and things like that, then when you have to have a bit of a question mark about him. Was it? Which one was that?
With your family.
Oh, was that in this particular case, was it?
Yes,
it's
accomplished by your family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, was it? Okay, I can't remember. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I have another question.
No, another one.
Yeah.
He's still alive, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And that one is very optimistic.
Yeah.
Difficult to
That's right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so. Sorry?
Did you say that monk was very alternative?
Obstinate. Okay. So the Buddha then says, yes, you're right, there were these families that were friends of the Bhikkhucanna, Sariputta, his intimates, and blameworthy, but I do not say to this extent he was blameworthy. Okay, so, you know, you, just because you're hanging around with people whose conduct might not be very good, then that doesn't necessarily mean that your conduct is good. Obviously, he could have been doing that and trying to help them, as indeed we saw Sariputta doing in other places. So the Dhananjani Sutta, we saw also Sariputta hanging around with the sort of corrupt tax collector, Dhananjani, and trying to help him and so on. And you know, maybe he could have been criticized for hanging around with him, and there's quite a few other places. So, Sariputta, when one lays down this body and clings to a new body, then I say one is blameworthy. So the Buddha's got a fairly high standard of what's being blameworthy here. So anybody who gets reborn is blameworthy.
It would seem he sees that there's nothing good for him to do. He's done what he needed to do.
Right. Yeah, well, that's what he said, yeah. He's parichinna. He's served the Buddha. Yeah. There was none of that in the Bhikkhucanna. The Bhikkhucanna used the knife blamelessly. So the Buddha's quite firm. Oh, that's the end, is it? Okay. And this is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Sariputta was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Just to have a quick look at the Chinese parallel. Okay. So we're in that place, in this place here, where the Buddha says to Sariputta, didn't Channa say that he had been blameless? In the Sanghutta Agama version, at the same point, the Buddha said to Sariputta, didn't Channa claim to honour the Buddha with what is pleasing? Okay, so in other words, that those two phrases, that Channa has served the Buddha with love, and the phrase that Channa is blameless, are essentially equivalent, and they're both statements implying that he's an arahant. So according to the Channavada Sutta and its parallel, Sariputta remarked that Channa had closely associated with lay families, a remark apparently meant to explain why Sariputta had thought Channa's claim to be mistaken. In reply, the Buddha clarified that he did not deem such association blameworthy, as only rebirth is blameworthy. So both the Pali and Chinese are essentially the same here, and they indicate that Channa passed away as an arahant. Now there's a peculiar little detail et here, which is that in the commentary, the commentary says that when he used the knife, Channa was still a worldling, he was still unenlightened, and it was only during the interval between using the knife and passing away that he developed insight and became an arahant. All right? It's a very dangerous way of attaining. It's a high risk path to arahantship. Yeah, it's like one shot. So this is this commentarial one, and of course the commentarial explanation here is a bit weird. And it implies that Channa, you know, you have to then sort of read back into it and imply that Channa was deluded earlier and making all these false claims and so on and so forth. And of course the sutta is very quite clear that Channa used the knife blamelessly, as it says here. So quite clear that at the time of using the knife, he was an arahant. We've already established that when it says he was blameless, that's what it meant. Because he means he's not going to get reborn. So it seems to me the sutta's fairly clear and fairly black and white that the Channa was actually an arahant at the time that he used his knife, whereas the commentary says that he used the knife and then became an arahant. Curiously enough, in a similar situation regarding the Bhikkhu Wakkali, where Bhikkhu Wakkali was also dying of a bad sickness, And then he also drew a knife and killed himself. Similarly, in that case, the commentary adds that Wakali was conceited and blind to his faults. He thought that he was enlightened, that he might rid himself of bodily pains by death. However, the stab with a knife caused him such pain that at the moment of dying, he realized that he was still unenlightened and putting forth great effort became an arahant. So it's exactly parallel situation, and the commentary also inserts this quite superfluous explanation, which is not merely extra to the text, but actually contradicts it. And so the question then, of course, is why is this? Why does the commentary feel the need to explain away these situations? Now, clearly, we have an ethically difficult and problematic case here, right, with an arahant who apparently kills himself, and the Buddha says, well, that's fine. Whoops. What happened about the first precept and all of these kinds of things? So it's clearly a problematic case. And so the commentary, the Theravadan commentary, prefers to sort of wiggle out of it by saying, well, he wasn't actually an arahant and it was only afterwards. Well, that's another point. Yes, you can argue that the Buddha... the Buddha committed suicide, yeah. Yeah, but he says, I'm going to lay down the life faculty. He didn't commit suicide physically, but he did make a mental determination to end his life. Yeah.
Didn't he tell Ananda, the Buddha could live, If he is asked to.
Yeah.
Then he told it, I think, two or three times to Ananda, and Ananda didn't get it.
Yeah, but that's. Yeah, but the whole situation is a bit confused. But at the Buddha's deathbed, there also is a passage where it says, that the Buddha lays down the will to live and says in 3 months' time he's going to pass away. So, but I'm not saying that he did commit suicide. I'm just saying that there's certainly a similarity or a parallel to that. Yeah.
Well, last year I was conferred by a 9-year-old boy. He asked me a very important question.
Mm-hmm.
You know what he asked? After he started with Jirusa when he was 7 years. I thought when he was 9 years, he already come to your Mahaparinipana Sutta.
Mm-hmm.
And when he see that the Buddha is your poison is put,
mm-hmm.
and he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me, when the Buddha, why the Buddha know that he put it very dangerous and poison and he mm-hmm. just eat it and die.
Yes.
Yeah.
9 years old. Wow. There's something problem with it. Yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting, yeah. Yes, yeah. That's an exception. I don't know many 9 year olds who have been reading their ways through the canon for 2 years already. In fact, I don't know all that many people who've been ordained for 9 years who've read their way through the canon that much. But anyway, okay.
There was a mention of a woman in time. I don't remember if it was the daughter or sister who never got married, and so she starved herself to death.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the daughter-in-law Sujata. Oh no, is that one? No, that's the daughter-in-law, that's another one. Okay, sorry. A bit further down. Sumana. Two elder ones became stream enterers. Sumana obtained the second fruit, Sakadagami, remained unmarried. Overwhelmed with disappointment because of a failure in finding a husband, she refused to eat and died. She was reborn in Tusita. Yeah. It's the commentary, okay? I wouldn't necessarily... I think probably a man wrote that passage. I think a man wrote that. Yeah, go on. Sorry?
Also in the Prajika, that in the origin story for killing,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it starts off with people killing themselves.
Right.
And then turn into a womb not killing others.
Mm.
So this notion of suicide is a little bit not consistent.
Right, it's a bit ambiguous, isn't it?
If you attempt suicide and then it's not successful, if it's still a child?
I think it's a Dukkha offense or something.
What is the Dukkha? To always kill yourself?
Yeah.
Don't be
suicide. Don't make it too.
Don't make it what?
It'll be too.
Yeah,
well, exactly. Yeah. It's the first thing you do. Yeah. If a monastic has attempted suicide, you go and say, "Well, that's a Dukkha offense. That's just as bad as walking on the floor with wet feet." Then you realise the gravity of what you've done. Yes. So, so this is the situation that we have these couple of cases. Now, clearly the tradition is struggling with it, right? And struggling with the ethical implications. Now, one of the characteristics of the Theravadin school was that they, and this was the defining issue in the first schism. The schism with Mahasanghika was that the Mahasanghika wanted to make their arahants a bit more worldly, a bit more kind of understandable, relatable, whereas the Theravada wanted to put their arahants up on a higher pedestal, and they're more completely pure and separated and cut off from everything, so they had a more pristine notion of what an arahant was. And it seems to me that's the tendency that we're seeing here, is that the Theravadin sort of commentators who were kind of worried by this idea that an arahant might kill themselves. So they try to kind of explain this away. Actually, this is something that does come up in other places. For example, in one passage, maybe the Mula Sarvasivada Vinaya, I can't remember exactly, but after the Buddha's Parinibbana, all of the arahants say to themselves, well, now the Buddha's died, there's no point in living. So they're all about to commit suicide. Right? So not just one or two who are gravely ill, but the whole lot of them are about to kill themselves. So, well, what's the point in living? And so it's only Mahakasapa who goes around and persuades them all, venerables, we've got to get together and recite the suttas for the sake of future generations. And if he hadn't done that, then they would have all just committed suicide en masse. It's very dramatic, isn't it? Yeah? The Mula Sarvasivada Vinaya does tend towards a slightly kind of soap opera-ish drama in its presentation of things. But anyway, it does show that this notion of the arahant being able to commit suicide was present there and was regarded quite differently in the different traditions. So as far as how it relates, now there's nowhere in the suttas where it explicitly says that only an arahant can commit suicide in these conditions and that nobody else can, right? However, the suttas, as we have them there, seem to fairly strongly imply that, you know, well, it's okay because he's an arahant, and that certainly seems to be the suggestion in that discussion, but it doesn't actually say that it's wrong in all other cases for somebody to commit suicide. Obviously, we're talking about a case when someone has an extremely painful terminal illness. They're not going to recover. So, you know, what's the point in just sort of lying there in agony for a few more days or a few more weeks? So then, of course, the practical consideration is how does this apply in cases of euthanasia and so on and so forth? And, of course, there's been no simple or easy answer to that. The whole problem of euthanasia is something which has become much more apparent in modern times, of course, with the advances in medicine. And so we are much more able to keep people alive for longer as they approach their death. I can't remember what the figures are, but it's something like that 90% of all medical expenses are incurred in the last 5 years of your life or something like that. So, you know, it's the incredible focus of resources on people in those last years to prop them up and keep them alive. And of course, one of the problems here is that you have, on the one hand, don't kill, fair enough, a very straightforward ethical precept. And on the other hand, you have the precept, or have the ethical principle, do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. Right? And if you were to look at it from that perspective, you can say, well, what would you want to happen? Most people, I don't know, I certainly speak for myself, and most people that I've talked to about it would say, well, don't keep me alive. When it comes my time to go, please let me go. You know, have compassion. I'm not interested just to hang around in pain and indignity and cost a lot of expense and, you know, being pumped full of drugs and, you know, it's just a hassle for my family and it doesn't do me any good and, you know. So obviously not everybody feels like that, but a lot of people do. So if that's what you would want for yourself, then is it the right thing to do if you think that it's what somebody else would want? Or if they've clearly expressed that's what they want. Most of the euthanasia bills that have been debated, and certainly in Australia, have been about voluntary euthanasia. So it's a case where somebody has said, you know, please euthanize me, whether they say it specifically at that time or whether they have it in a will or something like that. Of course, there are various forms of involuntary euthanasia as well. For example, if someone's in a coma and unable to come out of it. These things are dealt with all the time in hospitals, and you know, their doctors and the people who are looking after people in that situation are constantly making these kinds of choices. You know, how much is enough resources? How long do we keep somebody plugged into this machine? How long before we take our limited resources and then use them for helping somebody who might have a chance of recovering? Yeah.
A friend confided that she cut short her mother's life by a few minutes. I've wondered if that's a matricide.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this being a question from question of Buddhist ethics, because it said that somebody who kills their mother or father is one of the most terrible karmas that you can make. I personally don't think that would be a matricide. I don't think that's not what it means. That's not what the context is talking about. You know, you're acting obviously out of compassion. Now, it's not necessarily to say it's the right or wrong thing to do. And I think it's an area really where, at the end of the day, I don't know how possible it is to make clear guidelines. And each case in some ways is different, isn't it? I mean, the medical conditions are always different and person's wishes are different. And so it's very difficult to make very clear guidelines in that. But, you know, I mean, the context at which matricide and patricide is talked about is always, you know, a more straightforward case of murdering your mother and father. Just as in legal and normal ethical situations, you know, we don't use the word murder for that case. We use the word euthanasia because we understand. I mean, euthanasia means a good death, and we understand that the intention is not to murder somebody. The intention is to relieve someone from pain. So I definitely think that there's a clear ethical distinction between euthanasia and murder, and definitely we should not equate those two things. But that's not to say, and definitely euthanasia obviously is much less morally severe than murder is. But whether that means euthanasia is actually right or not, or justifiable or not, I don't know whether there's a clear or a straightforward way of being able to say that.
It's very difficult. So all family tell me she and I have to make a decision.
Mm.
suffering from the vicious karma. So finally, after I met you and I met your God, I admire my karma with the mind, you know, anybody has the right with the mind, how long she could live.
Right, she's still alive.
It's really when you are in the situation, you know how it feels. It's not easy at all, but it's very easy. But when to make decision concerning the person that you love more, it's very difficult.
The person involved in that act will be guilty, like subconsciously. Will it be comes in the last moment in the death bed?
Who knows? Yeah, I don't know.
The guilt will depend on circumstances.
I think that maybe they could do that, but yeah.
Things living wills, I mean, is that those things are written in advance.
Right.
But who knows the mindset of the person lying in bed, even though when they're feeling fine, they're like, oh no, don't leave me in that state. But when they're actually there and they're
right.
Over their attachments, they're like, give me another day. Like,
well, exactly, yeah. That's another point. And also, what is that state? You know, I mean, it's so variable. And, you know, the story that I has just told us. You know, the doctors don't always know. I mean, it happens all the time, you know.
It happens for many people.
Many people. It's not just occasional. Yeah.
It's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And to be in certain conditions.
Yeah.
There must also be a slight distinction between the euthanasia where you actually poisoning someone
opposed to euthanasia and the class on someone. Yeah, well, that's right, and there's normally in ethics you sort of acknowledge a distinction between an act which you perform and something which you refrain from. So a kind of classic example is, you know, do you push somebody in the water or do you simply not jump in the water to rescue somebody who's already drowning? Yeah? So they're kind of two slightly distinct things. The problem with that one is that normally you think that, well, it's less blameworthy to, you know, if it's not something you've actually done, it's not actually your intention, then it's less blameworthy. So if you walk along and you see someone drowning and you don't go in to save them, it might be considered blameworthy, but it's not considered murder. So we often might think we can apply that in the case of someone who's going to pass away, and maybe that's the case. But then one could also argue, is that simply a lack of moral courage? That you're failing to make the hard choice, and as a result of failing to make the hard choice, you're resulting in longer suffering for that person, yeah? And also resulting in, perhaps, you know, using up resources and so on, which can be used to help other people. So, yeah, I think it is a relevant... it is a relevant criterion, but as with many things in this area, it's why it's such a difficult area. It's very difficult to make. It does make some difference, but it interplays with so many other factors that it's hard to know exactly what the case is. Yeah.
You just have to become enlightened when you're making the decision.
Uh-huh, and then we're blameless. Yeah. Yeah. Easy. Yeah.
Like. Be handy, you know, psychic powers, forces can be called in at that time. What does the person want? What does the patient want? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was interesting that Sutta that it was, you know, the Buddha seemed to be pretty. In one last one that you read, you know, he actually said it.
Right, yeah. I mean, the Buddha wasn't necessarily in a habit of making big dramas out of things. but yeah, it's true. Yeah, he was fairly matter-of-fact about it. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's another another kind of thing, isn't it? I would be, you know, very cautious about what kinds of, you know, inferences that you can draw. I mean, this is obviously a very extreme circumstance. Yeah. Now, most precepts are things which are, you know, you can kind of break, need to be broken from time to time anyway. And the Vinaya is full of discussions of these kind of grey areas and exceptions and things like that. So it's not just, I mean, you know, in moral precepts cover a certain area, you know, of experience, and there are always boundary areas, and that's this is one of the boundary areas. You know, it's wrong to kill, but this is that border between life and death. You know, they're on that border, and so this is where those questions are not so clear. And, you know, this is, I think, one of the problems with fundamentalism is that, you know, fundamentalists, you know, you take up a very black and white moral principle and then you just apply it in a blanket way in every situation without regard to the context. And context does matter. So no matter who you are and no matter what the training or lifestyle that you're doing, you will encounter situations where there are grey areas and where how you're supposed to do things is not going to be decided by a list of precepts. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
But also, is it that in this case, it's not killing that would be harmful? I mean, it's not that he's just reading precepts, but it's that in this case, the act of killing causes himself no harm. He doesn't need any more life anyway.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
So, in a way, it doesn't quite apply in the same way.
Yeah, there's no harm. That's another point. Yeah, I mean, you know, others if it caused, say, people to criticize what they were doing, or if it caused others to think, oh well, the Buddha said suicide's all right, so you know, we can go away and do that. Yeah. So yes, that's a possibility. Yeah.
Anytime if you spend time in monastery, you've met people who go around declaring, believing that they're fully enlightened,
right.
And they're just not at all.
Right.
And yeah, there was one girl at my home monastery who was in hysterics because she had gotten fully enlightened and she believed, and she was going to pass away in 7 days if she didn't ordain immediately. She's weeping and demanding and begging to be ordained quickly.
It's those hysterical arahants that's the problem, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess that's kind of a weird idea. They might think, well, I'm an arahant, I can say you do this.
What did they do in that case? Did they give her the ordination?
No.
Did she die?
You want the whole story? How about over tea time?
Over tea time, yeah. I mean, I can imagine that somebody might die after 7 days if you're convinced of it enough. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, we should probably finish that off there. So that's the Channavada Sutta. Okay. Let's finish by paying respects. Yeah.